Beyond presents Spoilers for The Tragedy of Dido, Queen of Carthage by Christopher Marlowe and Thomas Nash. Discuss. Today we are looking at Act 1 in detail. I know, I said in previous episodes I was going to do fewer and less detailed spoilers from now on, but it's Marlowe and there's a lot to say, so... Following are some introductory notes intercut with a rough mix of our recording of the play. The same plain text edit will then follow for those who want to hear the text without interruptions. It was produced at the White Bear Theatre as part of our 2023 Revel season. There will be a better final cut, which will follow this release. As a live recording, there are some minor errors from the heat of the moment. If you want to just enjoy our production, stop listening now and wait for the release. Or if you're listening in the future, look for the episodes in the podcast list. This is an exercise some listeners aren't into. If it ain't for you, move on. If you're still listening, let's enter Spoiler Land.
Spoiler Land!
We didn't burn her. First off, this is a play which is fairly well known, so I will be keeping my breakdown fairly general, and I'm going to try and keep it mostly to production issues, which is kind of the point of these. I'm not here to really go very deep into some of the possible interpretations and things we can get. But I think we should first off just mention authorship. Not that it really matters a damn to a production. But Kit Marley and Thomas Nash are the attested authors. There has been lots of pushback on the Nash component, but it seems perfectly reasonable to me to suggest he was a collaborator, at least in terms of shape and plotting, if not the bulk of the actual dialogue. The dialogue is fairly consistent in the play, so hunting out divisions is a bit of a mug's game, and blah. Okay? So I think for benefit of the doubt, you should leave Thomas Nash's name in there. It seems reasonable. It was a play for a boys' company, the Children of the Chapel Royal, and so has a clearly defined act structure, which you should bear in mind. It will be a slight problem later on. It isn't really, but not so much an issue today. So Act 1 has a certain kind of unity. It is the setup of Aeneas and his backstory and the setting of the play. But by the end of the act, everyone is heading to the court of Queen Dido, though we won't meet her until Act 2. Whilst it is not a complex act, there are only two scenes with three sort of reasonably distinct units of action. The opening of the play, and everyone pretty much discovers this when they try to stage it, the opening of the play is a bitch. What do we open with? We open with the direction. Here the curtains draw. There is discovered Jupiter dandling Ganymede upon his knee, and Hermes lying asleep. So we open with horny Jupiter considering some godly pederasty with Ganymede, which is one issue, which we might dig into later, but let's just start with a more practical issue. Whilst it's fair to say the play digs into classical mythology a fair amount, mostly, after this first scene, the text will throw in one or two line examples within a more-to-the-point speech. I love you like X loved Y in such and such a myth. And those lines are either cuttable or have a clearly demonstrated meaning by the context. And they are, once we get into the text of the play, relatively sparse. Act 1, Scene 1 is different. Jupiter et al. Will just go off on one. And this is the opening of the play. And a modern audience, especially, do need to get their shit together. It's often a bit of a challenge to come into the first 5 minutes of any early modern play, and this play really just ladles it on very thick. So that's the first challenge for any production, not alienating your audience in the first 5 minutes through what sometimes feels like wanton obscurantism. And there is a balancing act here. It is possible to cut this scene to the bone. I mean, to get the primary plot information and leave the rest, you can pretty much do the first few lines of any speech and then the last few lines of any speech, and you can sort of take out most of the middle. But then, if you do that, does the scene have any impact? And that's before we dig into Jupiter Dandling Ganymede, who in a boys' company would probably be a younger member of the company. As a symbol for homosexual love in the early modern period and beyond, Ganymede's positioning here raises a whole series of questions about sexuality and gender. He is later described as a female wanton boy, especially as he's with an older predatory figure lusting after him here. So for modern audiences, and even the early modern, there are questions to address here in the differing ages that you probably have here between the two actors at play, and questions of consent with Ganymede. Especially today, there is a danger of that poisonous conflation of pederasty, paedophilia, with representation of homosexual desire. And that's combined with the general impression that the gods aren't exactly exemplars of conduct. The godly realm is presented as a world of unnatural, potentially here, pleasures and wantonness, and who will generally mess around with the humans and the human world. So, lots of things here to really think about in terms of presentation, considerably more than actually happened in our production, where I'd forgotten to actually cast someone as Ganymede and had to step in and read the part myself. Other questions for the staging. What do the gods look like in comparison with the human world? As you will see later, the worlds blur into each other. So the transition between god and human needs to be thought through so as, if nothing else, not to slow down the action with, you know, massive scene changes. So anyway, we are presented with this image of Jupiter dandling his Ganymede, a sleeping court follower languishing by him, completely ignoring his wife Juno and his other godly responsibilities.
Come, gentle Ganymede, and play with me. I love thee well, say Juno what she will.
My lord Jupiter, I am much better for your worthless love that will not shield me from her shrewish blows. Today, when as I filled into your cups and held the cloth of pleasance whilst you drank, she reached me such a rap for that I spilled as made the blood run down about mine ears.
What? Dares she strike the darling of my thoughts? By Saturn's soul and this earth-threatening hair that shaken thrice makes nature's buildings quake, I vow, if she but once frown on thee more, to hang her meteor-like twixt heaven and earth and bind her hand and foot with golden cords, as once I did, for harming Hercules.
Might I but see that pretty sport afoot. Oh, how would I with Helen's brother laugh and bring the gods to wonder at the game. Sweet Jupiter, if e'er I please thine eye, or seemed fair walled in with eagle's wings, grace my immortal beauty with this boon, and I will spend my time in thy bright arms.
What is't, sweet wag, I should deny thy youth, whose face reflects such pleasure to mine eyes, as I, exhaled with thy fire-darting beams, have oft driven back the horses of the night, when as they would have hailed thee from my sight. Sit on my knee and call for thy content. Control proud fate and cut the thread of time. Why are not all the gods at thy command and heaven and earth the bounds of thy delight? Vulcan shall dance to make thee laughing sport, and my nine daughters sing when thou art sad. From Juno's bird I'll pluck her spotted pride to make thee fans wherewith to cool thy face, and Venus' swans shall shed their silver down to sweeten out the slumbers of thy bed. Hermes no more shall show the world his wings, if that thy fancy in his feathers dwell, but as this one...
And Jupiter plucks a feather from Hermes' wing, which possibly doesn't please Hermes all that much, though... He might still be asleep, so who knows?
I'll tear them all from him, do thou but say. Their colour pleaseth me.
And then Jupiter throws his wife's wedding jewellery at Ganymede.
Hold here, my little love, these linked gems my Juno wear upon her marriage day. Put thou about thy neck, my own sweetheart, and trick thy arms and shoulders with my theft.
I would have a jewel for mine ear and a fine brooch to put into my hat, and then I'll hug you with an 100 times.
And shall have Ganymede if thou wilt be my love.
So Ganymede is being rewarded by horny Jupiter, and Hermes loses a feather, and we have a host of things at play. Jupiter is a serial adulterer and is ignoring his kingly duties because of his latest affair with a young man or boy. They're gods, so we don't have to be too literal here. In an early modern context, all of these things are frowned upon by society, to put it mildly. It is an image of wanton excess, not one of stoical fortitude. Now, in a more conventional text, like another play we did at the same time as recording this, like Cleopatra by Samuel Daniel, this excess would lead to the downfall of the characters, Cleopatra and Antony giving in to too much excess, and that is defeated by the stoical Romans. But this isn't that kind of play. I mean, Jupiter can play with Ganymede all he likes, and the worst that will happen is to other people. So there is something interesting going on about this concept and the way it's being presented here in this play. Anyway, for having set this scene up, enter Venus, who arrives with issues from the outside world. Again, between the first and the last four lines of this speech, it is a massive chunk of backstory delivered in a way that will probably alienate most people, and which we will get a more user-friendly iteration of later in the play. So you could argue it will get repeated in a clearer way, so maybe it's fine if we lose some people, because they're probably not going to get out of their seats yet. It's a balancing act. You decide. Anyway, basically, backstory, Aeneas is having a bad time because of your wife, Jupiter. Sort it out. To which Jupiter says, "All right, I'm on it. You know, work-life balance."
"Aye, this is it. You can sit toying there and playing with that female wanton boy while my Aeneas wanders on the seas and rests a prey to every billow's pride.
You're playing with your Ganymede whilst my son Aeneas is in mortal danger on the high seas. Juno is coming for him, having turned the wind and the sea against him." So now, though the text here goes into full classical literature overload, that's what's going on, even if it might not be clear.
"Juno. False Juno, in her chariot's pomp, drawn through the heavens by steeds of Boreas' brood, made Hebe to direct her airy wheels into the windy country of the clouds, where, finding Aeolus entrenched with storms and guarded with 1,000 grisly ghosts, she humbly did beseech him for our bane, and charged him drown my son with all his train. Then gan the winds break ope their brazen doors, and all Aeolia be up in arms. Poor Troy must now be sacked upon the sea, and Neptune's waves be envious men of war. Epeus' horse to Aetna's hill transformed prepared stands to wreck their wooden walls, and Aeolus, like Agamemnon, sounds the surges, his fierce soldiers to the spoil. See how the night Ulysses-like comes forth and intercepts the day as Dolon erst. Ah, me! The stars, surprised, like rhesus steeds, are drawn by darkness forth astrayest tents. What shall I do to save thee, my sweet boy? When as the waves do threat our crystal world, and Proteus, raising hills of floods on high, intends ere long to sport him in the sky."
In staging, you might want to do some visual representations, some projections, some shadow puppetry or something to just get across the important plot details here. Sea, water, bad stuff. Godly poetic flourish done, Venus gets to the point again. Oi, Jupiter, are people who are a bit less horny than you to be rewarded with death? Jupiter, a bit annoyed, goes, look, it's all in order. It's all scheduled. Aeneas is just having to go through a bit of a hardship phase as part of his heroic status upgrade. Okay?
False Jupiter! Rewards thou virtue so? What? Is not piety exempt from woe? Then die, Aeneas, in thine innocence, since that religion hath no recompense.
Content thee, Cytherea, in thy care, since thy Aeneas' wandering fate is firm, whose weary limbs shall shortly make repose in those fair walls I promised him of yore. But first, in blood must his good fortune bud, before he be the lord of Turnus' town, or force her smile that hitherto hath frowned. 3 winters shall he with the Rutiles war, and in the end subdue them with his sword, and full 3 summers likewise shall he waste in managing those fierce barbarian minds, which, once performed, poor Troy, so long suppressed, shall forth her ashes, advance her head, and flourish once again that erst was dead.
See, he's got a destiny, right? And not only that, but his son Ascanius will go even further than his dad. Okay?
But bright Ascanius, beauty's better work, who with the sun divides 1 radiant shape, shall build his throne amongst those starry towers that earth-born Atlas groaning under props. No bounds but heaven shall bound his empery, whose azured gates and chased with his name shall make the morning haste her grey uprise to feed her eyes with his engraven frame. Thus, in stout Hector's race, 300 years the Roman sceptre royal shall remain, till that a princess priest conceived by Mars shall yield to dignity a double birth, who will eternize Troy in their attempts.
All well and good, Jupiter, says Venus, but have you seen the weather forecast? I'm looking out of the window now, and it ain't good. Jupiter agrees to send Hermes off to adjust the thermostat on the weather controls to sunny.
How may I credit these thy flattering terms, when yet both sea and sands beset their ships? And Phoebus, as in Stygian pools, refrains to taint his tresses on the Tyrrhene main.
I will take order for that presently. Hermes, awake, and haste to Neptune's realm, whereas the wind god warring now with fate besieges the offspring of our kingly loins. Charge him from me to turn his stormy powers and fetter them in Vulcan's sturdy brass, that durst thus proudly wrong our kinsman's peace.
Exit Hermes, albeit sands of feather. How does this god make his exit? He's been on asleep throughout. So is it whoosh, or is it languid yawn saunter?
Venus, farewell. Thy son shall be our care. Come Ganymede, we must about this gear.
Exit Jupiter to dally further with Ganymede. So the play has set out the godly interference of the plot. Aeneas has a destiny to found Rome. Juno, Jupiter's wife, is against him. Venus is for him because of the usual god soap opera backstory stuff. It's important to note that the gods are just not very godly, that they aren't very virtuous, they're just powerful, and they have favourites, and they aren't fussed about ruining other people's lives. This is not a Christian universe. The exit of Jupiter leaves Venus on stage, and we have magical scene shifting. If this were a film, Venus would fade from Olympus and appear on a beach. But how you wish to demonstrate this transition of location is up to you. Now, an early modern stage would probably not bother changing the setting from one scene to another, though they did have an interest in doing so in different contexts. So having a massive scene change here is probably not a good idea, but we have electric lighting and we can do all sorts of things to make it look different. As Venus speaks, we shift focus to Carthage, where the rest of the play will occur. As promised, the sea calms. So there has been play for a soundscape throughout this godly sequence. As Venus spoke of waves, the sounds burst over the theatre. And here, Now that Hermes has finally found the thermostat, they drop down to the lapping of surf.
Disquiet seas, lay down your swelling looks and court Aeneas with your calmy cheer, whose beauteous burden well might make you proud had not the heavens, conceived with hell-born clouds, veiled his resplendent glory from your view. For my sake, pity him, Oceanus, that erstwhile issued from thy watery loins and had my being from thy bubbling froth. Triton, I know, hath filled his trump with Troy, and therefore will take pity on his toil and call both Thetis and Cymodoce to secure him in this extremity.
So, shift in location hinted at, enter Aeneas, Ascanius, and Achates, and others. The core company for Dido is quite small, but the extras can go as large as you like. In theory, we should have a load of random sailors coming on and being a bit bedraggled. Getting a clear picture of who Achates and the other followers are is important in your staging, though in the text, honestly, they are just a collection of yes-men. There isn't a lot of definition between them, but I'm sure it can be found. Ascanius is a child, and we will need to navigate his casting carefully, especially when we come to the role of Cupid later. Anyway, cast ashore, light a fire, look for food. Basic survival mode for these fellows. Venus narrates their arrival before joining the scene.
What? Do I see my son? Now come on shore. Venus! How art thou compassed with content, the while thine eyes attract their sought-for joys? Great Jupiter, still honoured mayst thou be for this so friendly aid in time of need. Here, in this bush disguised, I will stand, while my Aeneas spends himself in plaints, and heaven and earth with his unrest acquaints.
You sons of care, companions of my course, Priam's misfortune follows us by sea, and Helen's rape doth haunt ye at our heels. How many dangers have we overpassed? Both sparking Scylla and the sounding rocks, the Cyclops shelves and grim Serania's seat have you o'ergone, and yet remain alive. Pluck up your hearts, since fate still rests our friend, and changing heavens may those good days return, which Pergama did vaunt in all her pride.
Brave Prince of Troy, thou only art our God, that by thy virtues freest us from annoy, and makes our hopes survive to coming joys. Do thou but smile, and cloudy heaven will clear, whose night and day descendeth from thy brows, though we be now in extreme misery and rest the map of weather-beaten woe. Yet shall the aged sun shed forth his hair to make us live unto our former heat, and every beast the forest doth send forth, bequeath her young ones to our scanted food.
Father, I faint. Good father, give me meat.
Alas, sweet boy, thou must be still a while, till we have fire to dress the meat we killed. Gentle Achates, reach the tinderbox, that we may make a fire to warm us with, and roast our new-found victuals on this shore.
See what strange arts necessity finds out. How near, my sweet Aeneas, art thou driven?
Hold, take this candle and go light a fire. You shall have leaves and windfall boughs now near to these woods to roast your meat withal. Ascanius, go and dry thy drenched limbs, whilst I with my Achates rove abroad to know what coast and wind hath driven us on, or whether men or beasts inhabit it.
The air is pleasant and the soil most fit for cities and society's supports, yet much I marvel that I cannot find no steps of men imprinted in the earth.
Fire on stage. Oh, another tricky bit of health and safety in the workplace issues here. And you know, this is spoilers, so we'll talk about what happens later in the play. The use of fire in this play is quite important. So whilst this moment here of them on a beach trying to light a fire, this might seem cuttable, but actually it's quite clever foreshadowing and I really like it. Aeneas is lighting a fire in Carthage. It's small in Act 1. It's gonna get bigger in Act 5. Exeunt Ascanius and others. Now, the child is sent off with, you know, ASMs or whatever. There's an interesting moment here as Aeneas is almost hitting on his mum. I mean, she's a goddess, so staggering beauty. And that is quite a good route that the authors make to get into some more specific info dumping. So after the slightly impenetrable exposition in the Land of the Gods, where it seems to be that poetry just trumps clarity, in the Land of the Humans, we get straightforward things like, where am I? And who are you? And the answers being, we're in Carthage. This guy Aeneas is a survivor of the fall of Troy. Thank you. Thank you. Someone in the cheap seats is shouting.
Now is the time for me to play my part. Ho, young men. Saw you as you came any of my sisters wandering here, having a quiver girded to her side and clothed in a spotted leopard skin?
I neither saw nor heard of any such. But what may I, fair virgin, call your name, whose looks set forth no mortal form to view, nor speech berays aught human in thy birth? Thou art a goddess that deludes our eyes, and shrouds thy beauty in this borrowed shape. But whether thou the sun's bright sister be, or one of chaste Diana's fellow nymphs, live happy in the height of all content, and lighten our extremes with this one boon, as to instruct us under what good heaven we breathe as now, and what this world is called, on which by tempest's fury we are cast. Tell us, oh tell us that are ignorant, and this right hand shall make thy altars crack with mountain heaps of milk-white sacrifice.
Such honour, stranger, I do not affect. It is the use for Tyrian maids to wear their bow and quiver of this modest sort, and suit themselves in purple for the nonce, that they may trip more lightly o'er the lawns and overtake the tusked boar in chase. But for the land whereof thou dost inquire, it is the Punic kingdom, rich and strong, adjoining on Agenor's stately town the kingly seat of southern Libya, whereas Sidonian Dido rules as queen. But what are you that ask of me these things? Whence may you come, and whither will you go?
Of Troy am I. Aeneas is my name, who, driven by war from forth my native world, put sails to sea to seek out Italy, and my divine descent from sceptred Jove. With 12 Phrygian ships I ploughed the deep, and made that way my mother Venus led, but of them all scarce 7 do anchor safe, and they so racked and weltered by the waves as every tide tilts twixt their oaken sides, and all of them, unburdened of their load, are ballasted with billows' watery weight. But hapless I, God wot, poor and unknown, do trace these Libyan deserts all despised, exiled forth Europe and wide Asia both, and have not any coverture but heaven.
Fortune hath favoured thee, whate'er thou be, in sending thee unto this courteous coast. A God's name, on, and haste thee to the court, where Dido will receive ye with her smiles. And for thy ships, which thou supposest lost, not one of them hath perished in the storm, but are arrived safe, not far from hence. And so I leave thee to thy fortune's lot, wishing good luck unto thy wandering steps.
Exit Venus. Magically. We presume. Again, how do we present magical transitions of location and people? There's more magic to come and opportunities in thinking this element through in your production and presentation of the play. It really is. You need to make that decision probably really early on, because it probably also could be quite annoying to do. But simple sound effect and simple lighting change will do it, but you could do something a bit more exciting. If you establish a clear logic as to how the godly and the human worlds interact, you have covered a lot of the staging issues of this play, except for the fire. And that Venus does just disappear is, of course, important to the stage world, because this is what tips Aeneas off that he might have been perving up his mum a bit.
Achates, 'tis my mother that is fled. I know her by the movings of her feet. Stay, gentle Venus, fly not from thy son. Oh, too cruel. Why wilt thou forsake me thus, or in these shades deceiv'st mine eyes so oft? Why talk we not together hand in hand, and tell our griefs in more familiar terms? But thou art gone, and leav'st me here alone to dull the air with my discursive moan.
End of the first scene. We've gone from the gods down to a beach in Carthage, meeting Aeneas, his son, and there's a sense of who follow him and his plight. The second short scene will widen our field of view slightly, but it will not take us too much further. The play is taking its time in world building. Act 1, Scene 2. Enter Iarbas, followed by Ilioneus, Cloanthus, and Segestus. And others against, those ubiquitous extras. So we have Iarbas, who's well in at Carthage, more on him next time, and more of the followers of Aeneas. Three men who say some stuff meet an actual character who really counts. They appeal to actual character Iarbas for aid, having lost their compatriots. It's immediately clear that these are fellows of Aeneas.
Follow, ye Trojans, follow this brave lord, and plain to him the sum of your distress.
Why? What are you? And wherefore do you sue?
Wretches of Troy, envied of the winds that crave such favour at your honour's feet as poor distressed misery may plead, save, save, oh save our ships from cruel fire that do complain the wounds of thousand waves, and spare our lives, whom every spite pursues. We come not, we, to wrong your Libyan gods, or steal your household Lares from their shrines. Our hands are not prepared to lawless spoil, nor armored to offend in any kind. Such force is far from our unweaponed thoughts, whose fading wheel of victory forsook forbids all hope to harbor near our hearts.
But tell me, Trojans, Trojans if you be, unto what fruitful quarters were you bound before that Boreas buckled with your sails?
There is a place, Hesperia termed by us, an ancient empire, famous it for arms and fertile in fair Ceres' furrowed wealth, which now we call Italia, of his name that in such peace long time did rule the same. Thither made we, when suddenly gloomy Orion rose and led our ships into the shallow sands, whereas the southern wind with brackish breath dispersed them all amongst the wrackful rocks. From thence a few of us escaped to land. The rest, we fear, are folded in the floods.
Brave men-at-arms, abandon fruitless fears, since Carthage knows to entertain distress.
Aye, but the barbarous sort do threat our ships, and will not let us lodge upon the sands. In multitudes they swarm unto the shore, and from the first earth interdict our feet.
Myself will see that they shall not trouble ye. Your men and you shall banquet in our court, and every Trojan be as welcome here as Jupiter's silly Balkis house. Come in with me. I'll bring ye to my queen, who shall confirm my words with further deeds.
Thanks, gentle lord, for such unlooked-for grace. Might we but once more see Aeneas' face, then would we hope to quite such friendly turns as shall surpass the wonder of our speech.
Iarbas agrees to help these men sort out their boat issues and invites them to court for food. The scene is, in a sense, a repeat of information already given, but it draws us into the court of Carthage and mentions a queen who we will meet in the next act. It's a short scene, and if it wasn't an indoor playhouse, we'd say it was a scene to break up the action for Aeneas a bit. But there was probably a musical moment here at the end of Act 1 to cover trimming of candles, though it wasn't necessarily done every act, and the play is quite short. I bring up music between acts to point out that music is also an important element to this play. Sound and music, evoking the sea perhaps, and fire. More on that next time. And that's the end of the first act, the act that is all about setup of the gods, setup of Aeneas' plight, and anticipation of the arrival of Dido, our title character. The image of fire has been planted, the importance of Aeneas' future, the controlling power of the gods, the question of agency. Who here has actual control over their actions? This we will come back to later. The gods are not nice Christian angels, more devilish imps in their appetites. Now, Dido isn't a long play. At 14,500 words, it's a good 5,000 or 6,000 words shorter than your average tragedy, and even more so if it was a chunky one. And yet that doesn't automatically mean that it runs much shorter. The events of the play so far are languid. The opening of the play is of gods lounging and then exhausted sailors collapsing on a beach and asking for help or lighting a fire. So, pacing-wise, this isn't necessarily as short a play as on paper it appears. And that's it from this spoilers episode for Act 1 of Dido, Queen of Carthage. If you have any thoughts about my brief breakdown of the text, or if you have any disagreements, or if I'm in plain error, let me know. I might re-edit based on your thoughts. Probably won't, but you never know. In a moment, you will hear the rough-cut plain text, uninterrupted. But if you'd like more on this play, there are exploring sessions galore on the YouTube. Links in the show description. The recording used throughout this episode is a live mix of the performed play. It's a rough mix and focuses on the text as writ, so the final release will be cleaner and a more entertaining listen. In the version used throughout this recording, the cast was as follows. Keith Hill as Jupiter and Achates. Sarah Blake as Venus. Robert Crichton as Ganymede. Kit McGuire as Aeneas. Karim Promfley as Iarbas. Pamela Flanagan as Ascanius, Lindsay Beecham as Ilioneus, Alexandra Kataghida as Cloanthus, and Liza Graham was kind of Hermes at that point. I don't know if that bit actually makes it into the audio. You may also be able to hear some of the music by Rule Fox, though it's probably been taken out of this edit, and also many thanks to Valentina Vinci, who was our technical operator for the production. And I leave you now with a rough cut of Act 1 of Dido, Queen of Carthage, by Christopher Marlowe and Thomas Nash.
Come, gentle Ganymede, and play with me. I love thee well, say Juno what she will.
My lord Jupiter, I am much better for your worthless love that will not shield me from her shrewish blows. Today, when as I filled into your cups and held the cloth of pleasance whilst you drank, she reached me such a rap for that I spilled as made the blood run down about mine ears.
What? Dares she strike the darling of my thoughts? By Saturn's soul and this earth-threatening hair that shaken thrice makes nature's buildings quake, I vow, if she but once frown on thee more, to hang her meteor-like twixt heaven and earth, and bind her hand and foot with golden cords, as once I did, for harming Hercules.
Might I but see that pretty sporter foot. Oh, how would I with Helen's brother laugh and bring the gods to wonder at the game. Sweet Jupiter, if e'er I pleased thine eye, or seemed fair, walled in with eagle's wings, grace my immortal beauty with this boon, and I will spend my time in thy bright arms.
What is't, sweet wag, I should deny thy youth, whose face reflects such pleasure to mine eyes, as I, exhaled with thy fire-darting beams, have oft driven back the horses of the night, when as they would have hailed thee from my sight. Sit on my knee and call for thy content. Control proud fate and cut the thread of time. Why, are not all the gods at thy command and heaven and earth the bounds of thy delight? Vulcan shall dance to make thee laughing sport, and my 9 daughters sing when thou art sad. From Juno's bird I'll pluck her spotted pride to make thee fans wherewith to cool thy face, and Venus' swans shall shed their silver down to sweeten out the slumbers of thy bed. Hermes no more shall show the world his wings, if that thy fancy in his feathers dwell, but as this one...
Ah!
I'll tear them all from him, do thou but say, their colour pleaseth me. Hold here, my little love, these linked gems my Juno wear upon her marriage day. Put thou about thy neck, my own sweetheart, and trick thy arms and shoulders with my theft.
I would have a jewel for mine ear and a fine brooch to put into my hat, and then I'll hug you with 100 times.
And shall have Ganymede if thou wilt be my love.
Aye, this is it. You can sit toying there and playing with that female wanton boy while my Aeneas wanders on the seas and rests a prey to every billow's pride. Juno, false Juno, in her chariot's pomp, drawn through the heavens by steeds of Boreas' brood, made Hebe to direct her airy wheels into the windy country of the clouds, where... finding Aeolus entrenched with storms and guarded with 1,000 grisly ghosts, she humbly did beseech him for our bane and charged him drown my son with all his train. Then gan the winds break ope their brazen doors and all Aeolia be up in arms. Poor Troy must now be sacked upon the sea and Neptune's waves be envious men of war. Epeius' horse to Aetna's hill transformed prepared stands to wreck their wooden walls, and Aeolus, like Agamemnon, sounds the surges, his fierce soldiers to the spoil. See how the night, Ulysses-like, comes forth and intercepts the day as Dolon erst. Ah, me! The stars, surprised, like rhesus steeds, are drawn by darkness forth astray's tents. What shall I do to save thee, my sweet boy, when as the waves do threat our crystal world, and Proteus, raising hills of floods on high, intends ere long to sport him in the sky, false Jupiter? Rewardst thou virtue so? What? Is not piety exempt from woe? Then die, Aeneas, in thine innocence, since that religion hath no recompense.
Content thee, Cytherea, in thy care, since thy Aeneas' wandering fate is firm, whose weary limbs shall shortly make repose in those fair walls I promised him of yore. But first, in blood must his good fortune bud, before he be the lord of Turnus' town, or force her smile that hitherto hath frowned. 3 winters shall he with the Rutiles war, and in the end subdue them with his sword, and full 3 summers likewise shall he waste in managing those fierce barbarian minds, which, once performed, poor Troy, so long suppressed, shall forth her ashes, advance her head, and flourish once again that erst was dead. But bright Ascanius, beauty's better work, who with the sun divides 1 radiant shape, shall build his throne amongst those starry towers that earth-born Atlas groaning under props. No bounds but heaven shall bound his empery, whose azured gates and chased with his name shall make the morning haste her grey uprise to feed her eyes with his engraven frame. Thus, in stout Hector's race, 300 years the Roman sceptre royal shall remain, till that a princess priest conceived by Mars shall yield to dignity a double birth, who will eternize Troy in their attempts.
How may I credit these thy flattering terms, when yet both sea and sands beset their ships? And Phoebus, as in Stygian pools, refrains to taint his tresses on the Tyrrhene main.
I will take order for that presently. Hermes, awake, and haste to Neptune's realm, whereas the wind god warring now with fate besieges the offspring of our kingly loins, charge him from me to turn his stormy powers and fetter them in Vulcan's sturdy brass, that durst thus proudly wrong our kinsman's peace. Venus, farewell. Thy son shall be our care. Come, Ganymede, we must about this gear.
Disquiet seas, lay down your swelling looks and court Aeneas with your calmy cheer, whose beauteous burden well might make you proud had not the heavens, conceived with hell-born clouds, veiled his resplendent glory from your view. For my sake, pity him, Oceanus, that erstwhile issued from thy watery loins and had my being from thy bubbling froth. Triton, I know, hath filled his trump with Troy, and therefore will take pity on his toil and call both Thetis and Cymodoce to secure him in this extremity. What? Do I see my son? Now come on shore. Venus, how art thou compassed with content the while thine eyes attract their sought-for joys? Great Jupiter, still honoured mayst thou be for this so friendly aid in time of need. Here, in this bush disguised, I will stand, while my Aeneas spends himself in plaints, and heaven and earth with his unrest acquaints.
You sons of care, companions of my course, Priam's misfortune follows us by sea, and Helen's rape doth haunt ye at our heels. How many dangers have we overpassed? Both sparking Scylla and the sounding rocks, the Cyclops shelves and grim Serania's seat have you o'ergone, and yet remain alive. Pluck up your hearts, since fate still rests our friend, and changing heavens may those good days return, which Pergama did vaunt in all her pride.
Brave Prince of Troy, thou only art our God, that by thy virtues freest us from annoy, and makes our hopes survive to coming joys. Do thou but smile, and cloudy heaven will clear, whose night and day descendeth from thy brows, though we be now in extreme misery and rest the map of weather-beaten woe. Yet shall the aged sun shed forth his hair to make us live unto our former heat, and every beast the forest doth send forth bequeath her young ones to our scanted food.
Father, I faint. Good father, give me meat.
Alas, sweet boy, thou must be still a while, till we have fire to dress the meat we killed. Gentle Achates, reach the tinderbox, that we may make a fire to warm us with and roast our new-found victuals on this shore.
See what strange arts necessity finds out. How near, my sweet Aeneas, art thou driven?
Hold, take this candle and go light a fire. You shall have leaves and windfall boughs enow near to these woods to roast your meat withal. Ascanius, go and dry thy drenched limbs, whilst I with my Achates rove abroad to know what coast and wind hath driven us on, or whether men or beasts inhabit it.
The air is pleasant and the soil most fit for cities and society's supports, yet much I marvel that I cannot find no steps of men imprinted in the earth.
Now is the time for me to play my part. Ho, young men! Saw you as you came any of my sisters wandering here, having a quiver girded to her side and clothed in a spotted leopard skin?
I neither saw nor heard of any such. But what may I, fair virgin, call your name, whose looks set forth no mortal form to view, nor speech berays aught human in thy birth? Thou art a goddess that deludes our eyes, and shrouds thy beauty in this borrowed shape. But whether thou the sun's bright sister be, or one of chaste Diana's fellow nymphs, live happy in the height of all content, and lighten our extremes with this one boon, as to instruct us under what good heaven we breathe as now, and what this world is called, on which by tempest's fury we are cast. Tell us, O tell us that are ignorant, and this right hand shall make thy altars crack with mountain heaps of milk-white sacrifice.
Such honour, stranger, I do not affect. It is the use for Tyrian maids to wear their bow and quiver of this modest sort, and suit themselves in purple for the nonce, that they may trip more lightly o'er the lawns and overtake the tusked boar in chase. But for the land whereof thou dost inquire, it is the Punic kingdom, rich and strong, adjoining on Aeginor's stately town the kingly seat of southern Libya, whereas Sidonian Dido rules as queen. But what are you that ask of me these things? Whence may you come?
And whither will you go?
Of Troy am I. Aeneas is my name, who, driven by war from forth my native world, put sails to sea to seek out Italy, and my divine descent from sceptred Jove. With 12 Phrygian ships I ploughed the deep, and made that way my mother Venus led, but of them all scarce 7 do anchor safe, and they so racked and weltered by the waves as every tide tilts twixt their oaken sides, and all of them, unburdened of their load, are ballasted with billows' watery weight. But hapless I, God wot, poor and unknown, do trace these Libyan deserts, all despised, exiled forth Europe and wide Asia both, and have not any coverture but heaven.
Fortune hath favoured thee, whate'er thou be, in sending thee unto this courteous coast. A God's name, on, and haste thee to the court, where Dido will receive ye with her smiles, and for thy ships, which thou supposest lost. Not one of them hath perished in the storm, but are arrived safe, not far from hence. And so I leave thee to thy fortune's lot, wishing good luck unto thy wandering steps.
Achates, 'tis my mother that is fled. I know her by the movings of her feet. Stay, gentle Venus, fly not from thy son. Oh, too cruel. Why wilt thou forsake me thus, or in these shades deceiv'st mine eyes so oft? Why talk we not together hand in hand, and tell our griefs in more familiar terms? But thou art gone, and leav'st me here alone to dull the air with my discursive moan.
Follow, ye Trojans, follow this brave lord, and plain to him the sum of your distress.
Why? What are you? And wherefore do you sue?
Wretches of Troy, envied of the winds that crave such favour at your honour's feet as poor distressed misery may plead. Save, save, oh save our ships from cruel fire that do complain the wounds of 1,000 waves, and spare our lives whom every spite pursues. We come not, we, to wrong your Libyan gods, or steal your household Lares from their shrines. Our hands are not prepared to lawless spoil, nor armoured to offend in any kind. Such force is far from our unweaponed thoughts, whose fading wheel of victory forsook forbids all hope to harbour near our hearts.
But tell me, Trojans if you be, unto what fruitful quarters were you bound before that Boreas buckled with your sails?
There is a place, Hesperia termed by us, an ancient empire, famoused for arms and fertile in fair Ceres' furrowed wealth, which now we call Italia, of his name that in such peace long time did rule the same. Thither made we, when suddenly gloomy Orion rose and led our ships into the shallow sands, whereas the southern wind with brackish breath dispersed them all amongst the wrackful rocks. From thence a few of us escaped to land. The rest, we fear, are folded in the floods.
Brave men-at-arms, abandon fruitless fears, since Carthage knows to entertain distress.
Aye, but the barbarous sort do threat our ships, and will not let us lodge upon the sands. In multitudes they swarm unto the shore, and from the first earth interdict our feet.
Myself will see that they shall not trouble ye. Your men and you shall banquet in our court, and every Trojan be as welcome here as Jupiter's silly Balkis house. Come in with me. I'll bring ye to my queen, who shall confirm my words with further deeds.
Thanks, gentle lord, for such unlooked-for grace.
Might we but once more see Aeneas' face, then would we hope to quite such friendly terms as shall surpass the wonder of our speech.
This spoilers episode was hosted and produced by myself, Robert Crichton, for the Beyond podcast. Follow us on social media at Beyond Shakes. visit our website at beyondshakespeare.org or support our work by becoming a patron at patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. Goodbye.